Q&A. Bring Judy back. Okay. Here, let's try this again. Good morning, everybody. Today is Saturday, December 15th, 2018. Welcome to our Contract Trust Conference Call. We're not accountants, tax professionals, lawyers, or currency dealers. We are not engaged in rendering legal, tax, accounting, or other professional advice. Should you require those services, you should retain competent advice from a professional in that field. I'd like to thank you for joining us today. We've been talking about trust and asset protection for quite some time now. As we continue to wait for the announcement of the long-awaited RV, those pesky 800 numbers, we thought it would be a good time to review some basics and share what we've learned about preparing for your change. My partner Jim Knox and my good friend Judy are here today as well. So, Judy, would you like to get started today?
I would like that, Carol. I'd like to start off, if you don't mind, with I recently read a couple of emails from someone who identifies himself as Mother, Esquire, who suggests that we wait until after our exchange to open up any asset protection vehicle. You and Jim have obviously always suggested we get our trust in place first. What are your thoughts on that email that was so widely disseminated?
Yeah. Well, I read that email too, and actually, I got several questions and comments on it. Mother says the first thing he is going to do is open up a broker account in his own name. I hope my phone will stop ringing. He's going to open a broker account in his own name. He says that side of the bank has a higher fiduciary responsibility than the retail side. That may be so, but the bank still becomes your partner. And, you know, I don't think any of us want that. I think the phone has stopped ringing now. I'm sorry about that, guys. My guess is that most people listening to my calls and those of others have all heard that the secret of asset protection is to control it, not to own it. Ownership brings a potential for loss. So if you don't own it, no one can take it with you. Take it from you. And, you know, I've given this rather extreme example before, but it's certainly a possibility. Suppose after you exchange your currency, you're so excited you have a heart attack and die. All that money then becomes probate fodder and open to estate and inheritance taxes. And it would be a long, long time before your family sees any of that money. Another scenario, you're in an automobile accident and some hungry attorneys see you as a mail ticket. Mother states that rich people don't set up entities before they're rich. No, they did not. But if they even anticipated any wealth and responsibilities that come with it, they certainly did their research, which is what you are doing by listening to my calls and the others out there. Rich people set up trusts and have been for centuries. Why? Because they work. You have the opportunity. We are all expecting to be rich. You're doing your research. You're planning ahead of time. So for him to say something like, rich people didn't set up trust ahead of time, well, because they didn't. They grew their wealth. We, on the other hand, are expecting to get hit with it in the face. One day we're going to be rich. So we are all making plans for it. We're doing our research. We are making plans. And the trusts work because the trusts work really well. They have for centuries.
Awesome. Carol, he also mentioned taxes. I thought it was pretty well established that this RV was not going to be a taxable event.
Well, you're right, Judy. Everything we've heard for the last several years is the RV itself will not be a taxable event. But given that, we should be prudent. It has been suggested, and we concur, that you set up a special tax account. You're encouraged to hold 15 to 50% of your funds for a year to offset any possible tax implications. If there are no implications after a year, have the bank sweep those funds back into a holding account and close this account. So if it is taxable for whatever reason, and we are only expecting a 2% treasury tax, you're covered because you've got 15 to 50% set aside. So you're okay. And if it's not taxable after a year, you have the bonus of all this money that you set aside, probably making interest on it. So you sweep the money back into a holding account. You know,
okay.
I think most of us have funds that we need to address post-RV, whether it be outstanding debt, a new car, helping out friends. We don't want to pay taxes on it if we don't have to. And we've shared a scenario which you may consider at your exchange in order to take advantage of this one-time tax break. And I've repeated this many times, so a lot of you probably know it as well as I do. I'm looking for something here. Anyway, so at the exchange, how about this scenario? Mr. Banker, I now have X million dollars. I would like you to put $250,000 into my personal account. Here is my account number, wire instructions. I would like to take $9,500 cash with me when I leave today, as well as a preloaded debit card attached to my new personal account. Now, I understand that the limit is now up to $15,200 that we can take, but anything over $10,000 or at the $10,000 mark is going to require a FinCEN, so you probably don't want to do that. I will need these wires to be sent, and here's a list of cashier's checks that I need. And at this point, I understand we can request up to 7 of each. I will need a pass-through account of X number of dollars. I would like to put the balance into account at ABC at your bank for ABC Trust for a long-term mutually beneficial relationship. Here's my paperwork. The abstract and EIN should be all that you need. Now, again, folks, I'm not a CPA or tax planner. It's just my opinion. We might be able to take advantage of this one-time tax break. You know, obviously pretty simplified, but you get the idea.
Exactly. Thank you, Carol. So he also mentions LLCs, foundations, and many types of trusts. What makes your contract trust so special?
Well, as we mentioned before, all of these entities have great value when properly crafted and operated. The common law contract trust that we create was drafted by an attorney in the 1980s. It was declared a valid legal entity by IRS expert witness. The creation of the trust allows you, the initial exchanger, to be the trustee. And in my mind, that's what makes this so superior to any other trust. Your trust can be the second, your spouse can be the second trustee. There's no one between you and your money. You can hire all the advisors you want or need, but ultimately you make the final decisions. This trust was This trust was designed in contemplation of life, not of death, as your most revocable living trust. You can name your children as successor trustees, even add a bloodline clause so the trust remains in your family. You can add a spendthrift clause so no future participants in the trust can hypothecate their interest in any way. And although the trust does not have unlimited life, it can be renewed every 25 years.
Wow. Okay, Carol, so you mentioned sharing some exchange preparation tips. I'm sure we'd all like a summation, as there has been so much information put out there lately. What are your thoughts?
Well, before I get on to that, Judy, I see that Jim has joined us. Are you there, Jim?
I am here.
Oh, good.
Hi, Jim.
Hello.
Hello, you little Oregon guy, you.
So, Jim, you want to take off on this, or you want me to start with it? What do you want to do?
Go ahead and start.
Okay. Well, Judy, thanks for asking these questions, because there is so much going on. And although nobody knows exactly what to expect, some people have shared their ideas on the Internet and in emails. Jim and I have discussed a few things we've seen and heard and feel this is a pretty good list of ideas. Now, you know, I may get a little wordy here because we've had so much information, so I will try to keep it reasonable. And Jim, if you want to interrupt, or Judy, if you want to interrupt, please do so. The very first thing you must do is call that 800 number and set up an appointment for exchange. We have heard the call centers will be open for 8 days only. You can set up your appointment when it's convenient for you, but, you know, as they say, the early bird gets the worm. And higher rates may not be available after 2 weeks. We recently heard that Zim must be redeemed by December 22nd, period. But this may or may not be true. I mean, like anything else, there's so much rumor going on.
Right.
It is suggested that you tell them when you make your appointment how much of which currency you hold. If you're planning on bringing a friend, advisor, or partner to the appointment, you must notify the bank on this call. Confirm the time and place of your exchange appointment. Ask for an email address to further confirm the appointment. The pre-exchange email is where you will reiterate what currencies you have, discuss any other issues you may have, as well as sending them a short bio about yourself. You want to impress him that you would like to create a long-term mutually beneficial relationship. You want to impress upon them that you are making plans, that you know what you're doing, that you are just not walking into the bank with a bunch of currency and say, give me money. Right. One of the things you want to mention at your in the exchange email is that you want a waiver of transaction fees. And as I've mentioned before, I do have that form if you'd like one. If you do have Zim, you will more than likely be sent to an exchange center, not to a retail bank. At this time, HSBC and Wells Fargo are the only ones exchanging Zim. HSBC is the lead bank. From what I have read, there should be representatives from all the major banks at the exchange centers. So don't worry if there isn't an HSBC or Wells Fargo in your area. I've also heard that once this RV occurs, HSBCs will be popping up all over the place. In terms of buying other banks, just opening in new areas, they are probably going to be the biggest bank in the country. I've heard that most exchange centers will be within 80 miles of your home. If you feel the need for security, mention it when you make your appointment. They may be able to assist you. In any event, if you feel the need for security and they can't assist you, hire it yourself. I mean, have somebody drive you there. I mean, I'm personally going to have somebody drive me to this appointment. I'm not even going to think about driving myself there. You need to be relaxed when you get there. Arrive no more than 5 minutes early. Expect to be there for hour and a half. It could be shorter, it could be longer, but that's what I've heard. The average is going to be about an hour. We've heard that you'll go through several stations while you're there. Security, where you have to show two pieces of photo ID, two utility bills showing your current address. And this applies to who's ever with you, whether it be a spouse, a partner, an advisor, an attorney, they need to show their ID as well. Have your abstract of trust in your EIN letter with you too. I doubt that anyone will want to see the entire trust, but if it makes you feel better, put it in your briefcase in case it's needed. Do not offer it. Verifications of currencies is another station. The currencies will be run through a dealer room machine. Your currency should be arranged by country and denomination. Have several copies of a spreadsheet with this information as well. Don't let the currency out of your sight. And ask for a written receipt of the currency when you do exchange it. We've heard conflicting advice about currency receipts. Some say you will need them, some say no. Personally, I doubt that you will need them at the exchange. Same with gift letters. I think they're going, my personal opinion is I think they're going to apply more at tax time than anything else. So at the actual exchange, show them your bio and let them know who you are. You know, if you have accounts at their bank, let them know. Have your spreadsheets with the anticipated rates. If you want to negotiate higher rates, politely ask to see the back screen or contract rates. They will show it if you ask, but they will not offer it if you don't ask. I have been told you will more than likely get whatever you ask for. So ask for it. The money, if you don't get the money to use it for your humanitarian purposes or whatever, it's just the bank gets to hold on to that much more money. So it's you're the one that's been sitting on all this currency for all this time. You have the right, you have those higher rates. Again, present a waiver form to avoid fees on this transaction. The fees could run up to 1.5%. So when you're talking millions of dollars, that's potentially a great deal of money. Jim, I see you just chimed in again. You have any comments?
No, I've just been sitting here watching you go.
Oh, okay. All right. Ask to work with a relationship manager or banking assistant. You need to have somebody to buffer you for a lot of these things. You need to have a 10-day plan, a 30-day plan, a 90-day plan. What are you going to do the first 10 days? You're going to run out and buy a house, buy a car? You're going to pass that money to your friends and family for Christmas? You know, whatever it may be, have a plan. In 30 days, you may want to move across country. You may want to buy an airplane. Whatever it is, just have a short plan. Give your vision of how you intend to use the funds. You do want to support humanitarian projects, provide jobs, etc. let them know you'll be working with a professional wealth management, trust management team to build a multi-generational plan. And any of you, if you have Zim, obviously this is going to be multi-generational. If you have reserves, take proof of purchase. Know the amount needed and have the wiring instructions from your dealer to do a wire transfer or get a cashier's check in order to pay them off. You will probably have to sign an NDA, especially if you have Zim. Read it. If it works for you, sign it and initial each page. If there's a question, ask the question. Maybe they can resolve the issue for you. And ask for a copy for your records. Have summaries of your humanitarian projects. A bullet list of the high points should be sufficient for this first meeting. Now, you know, this is interesting. People that are humanitarian, well, I have to come up with my own project. Well, many of you have, and they're admirable. Like Gary was mentioning earlier, what he plans to do to put former veterans and police officers to work protecting all the schools in the area. Most of these are very, very admirable, but doesn't mean you have to come up with your own plan. You know, I personally, I'm not coming up with my own plan. But there's so many other humanitarian, projects out there that we can invest in or fund that we don't have to come up with our own stuff. So before you get all nervous, what am I going to do about this? You know, investigate some other things that you might want to be interested in funding. Have a list of what you want to take with you when you leave. You know, cash, like I mentioned earlier. Preloaded debit cards, any wires or cashier's checks. Do not plan on anything more than $500,000, as it might be investigated for money laundering. If you need emergency money to save your house, etc., let them know. Your relationship manager should be able to facilitate all this for you. You know, if you're looking at buying a new home, you might want to have money for escrow. Your relationship manager should help you with all of that.
Let me jump in for a second, Carol.
Sure.
All right, on the house. Yes, you want to have as much money in there to take care of the house for 6, 7, 8, 10 years. You want enough for your property taxes, known maintenance, improvements, modifications, cleaning the yard. Just put it all in a group chunk of money there. I mean, just put it. Figure out what you need, and then put it in that trust, and then put it into some type of an instrument. Your wealth manager will tell you, okay, well, we can get you 2% for this or 3% if we put it here. The higher percent, the more the risk. You don't want to risk that money. Just get it working a little bit. So when you start planning for your real estate purchases, allocate some money there for property tax, maintenance, known issues that you want to take care of, like re-landscaping or addition to the house. Just be sure to put that money in. Yeah, definitely insurance. Lots of insurance. Don't skimp on the insurance. That's my advice.
I agree. I totally agree. So also make sure to get at least 20 cleaning clear certificates and proof of funds letters for realtors, investment advisors, etc. I mean, you don't want to walk into your neighborhood Jaguar dealer and just sit down and write a check for $90,000 without expecting it to be investigated. So make sure you have your clean and clear certificates. Get cards, business cards, and contact information from everybody. And have cards of your own to pass out to those with whom you're working. You know, have all of your stuff neatly organized in a three-ring binder. And don't forget to bring your currency with you. You may have all of your paperwork neatly organized in a binder, but I doubt if you've got the currency sitting around in a binder on your desk. So don't forget to bring it. And that does
that
sound rather redundant, but it's possible.
That's so cute, Carol. That is so cute. Don't forget the currency.
Yeah, don't forget the money. Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
I've heard that we'll more than likely not be allowed to bring a cell phone or a laptop. So maybe a small handheld calculator would be a good thing, especially because you don't know what the rates are going to be. So you don't know how much you want to do where, but if you don't know what the rates are. But Jim, you said something about if you offered to turn off Wi-Fi or something, they should be able to bring a phone?
Well, you just show them that you got it on airplane mode, so there's no Wi-Fi, nothing coming through, no phone calls coming in, and then you should be able to use your phone for your calculator.
that's a really good idea, because I think most of us would be more comfortable with our smartphone than we would an old-fashioned handheld calculator.
You have to learn how to use it again.
Yeah, exactly. You want to go into anything here, Jim, or you want me to talk about bank accounts?
Well, no, continue. I'll just jump in here. You're doing such a great job, and I'm following along on the transcript also. There's only nothing I could change. I mean, you've done some superior job, Carol.
Oh, thanks.
As always, Jim. As always, Carol.
You see, guys, why I have these people around me? Anyway, over the years, obviously, I've collected a lot of information. And some years ago, I got a piece of information about bank accounts from a gal named Deb Tarheel Girl. Many of you have probably heard of her. And it was about bank accounts. And I asked her about it. I asked her if she wrote it. And she said, no, I did not write it, but it was written by a former Treasury agent. Well, given that, I think that's pretty close to gospel about what we should do and why we should do it. So I reprinted it. I've sent it out to a lot of people. I've got some of it here that I would like to read to you. And again, if you want this information, just email me and I'll send it to you. So what you're going to do is open up a separate account for each kind of currency. For example, account number 1A for dinar and account number 1B for dong, maybe account 1C for zim. The reason for separate accounts for different currencies is to differentiate, if necessary for tax purposes, between currencies which were tradable and currencies which are not tradable prior to revaluation. It is our understanding that the revaluation of a tradable currency is not, in and of itself, a taxable event. So the following steps will keep following each currency separately. You may combine the separate currency account assets into the holding account at the end. So once account number one is open, deposit your currency into the account and exchange into the new treasury currency, which I understand is now out, the new U.S. notes, or UST, I guess. Immediately, have the bank open a second account, account number two, and have the bank sweep everything from account number one into account number two. Have the bank close account number one. Repeat this step for account number three and have the bank sweep account number two into account number three and close account number two. Kind of overkill, but there's a reason. The reason you are doing this is that the bank is required to report the opening of account number one to the federal government, and that information can find its way into the public domain. However, the bank is not required to report intra-bank transfers between accounts. What this does is effectively eliminate your digital trail so that nobody outside the bank knows how much money you have on deposit, and more importantly, whether or not you are a good target for a lawsuit. You will do this for the IQD account, the VND account, the ZIM account, and any other currencies you may hold. If there is a need to utilize funds for personal use or to pay for a trust to be established, it is encouraged to pull these funds either in cash, less than $10,000, or in a cashier's check on your first visit and take it to your respective bank. Use account number three for this. Okay. These are some suggestions for different accounts, and that's all these are suggestions, and as I say, I did not write this. The mother load holding account. Now, most of you who currently have trust with me have one trust, and we always have called that the mother load trust. That's going to be the one that holds all the money. This will be a non-interest-bearing account which will hold the bulk of your funds. And this is very important. You do not want online access or debit cards for this account. Checks only. And actually, I wouldn't even do checks. I would make it all...
Bank checks.
Bank checks. Face-to-face with your banker, or if you're going to need to talk with them on the phone, personal code words, that kind of stuff.
Right.
And many of you want to have a tithe account. 10% of your funds to be used for charitable giving. You probably don't need online access for debit cards for this either, but just checks. Because if you go to the way, that's how the way you're going to do your tithe is more than likely with a check. A Mad Money account. 10% of your funds to be used for self-indulgent playing, vacations, and luxury purchase. Again, I didn't write this. I suggest a different name other than Mad Money. 10% may be excessive. Online access, debit cards, and checks should be okay for this account. Tax account. Once again, you are encouraged to hold 15 to 50% of your funds for a year to offset any possible tax implications. If there are no tax implications after a year, have the bank sweep these funds back into the holding account and close this account. Again, you probably don't need online access or debit cards for this account. Project account. This could come into your humanitarian, whatever. It all depends how you break it all down. We recommend no more than 20% of your funds in this account. This account will be the funding source from where all the funds will come from business ventures and projects. Again, you probably don't need online access or debit cards for this account. Again, I would stress this should be personal banker relationship only. We've all seen things, and I neglected to write it down here. You want these accounts to be hidden from the tellers, tagged for not for learning. Nobody else can see these accounts. I wish I'd written this down because I don't know the exact verbiage. Judy, do you remember that verbiage?
My private banker told me it was an account that I can't remember the name of what she actually called it, but nobody can touch it but your private banker / wealth manager, and you will have a verbal code with them.
Yeah,
privacy. It's a privacy.
Yeah, that's what I thought. And the last account you're going to want to open is a maintenance or household account. This will be the only account that will not be in your trust or any trust. This account will be the one that you use daily. The account should never hold over $50,000 for liability purpose. Even though I just told you 5 minutes ago you want $250,000, once you get settled and you bought the new car, you've done this, this, that, and the other, you don't ever want to have too much money in that account. This account can be funded with a recurring transfer from the holding account in the form of a monthly stipend, such as a trustee compensation, that should be used to cover expenses. You know, it's not clear at this time whether this would create a taxable event, but I believe if it does, it would be 1040, 1099 taxable income. Online access, debit cards, and checks should be okay for this account. Now, you know, once again, all of your stuff is going to be paid for. You're not going to have a mortgage payment. You're not going to have a car payment. Hopefully, you won't have an airplane or boat payment. But, you still have monthly expenses. You know, everybody still is going to have to pay their electric bill and their telephone bill and their cell phone bill and all that kind of stuff. So we all still need monthly income coming in, and that's where the trustee compensation comes in. That's how you pay for all that stuff. And again, you know, back to the taxable income, we don't know what that's going to be. That may all change drastically with the implementation of NYSERDA if that happens. But at this time, all we can talk about is what's true right now. So, and once again, the trust will purchase and provide everything, provide and own everything that you need. You will own nothing but control everything. You know, you will probably want to pay off your existing mortgage. You should still create a mortgage from the trust. You want to, if possible, encumber the asset. Even though the house is probably going to be in a real estate trust, you want to keep it encumbered so nobody thinks it's a target to go after. And, you know, there's a whole bunch of methodology to that, and we can go into that at some later date. Just giving you some ideas here. If you're over 62, and depending how much money you have, you may wish just to consider reverse mortgage, and that could be your income as well. When ordering checks from your bank, request them to print the following above the signature line, acting strictly in the capacity of trustee and not otherwise. Any bank check printing company should be able to do this. I have never had one turn me down. Also, ask that the word trustee is printed either above, before, after, or directly below the signature line. They may or not be able to do this. If they cannot accommodate your request, just write the word trustee after your signature. So, as I said, this was kind of wordy. I hope you were taking notes. But in any event, I do have all this, and I'd be happy to send it to you if you like. So I think unless either Jim or Judy has anything to add, we should just open it up to Q&A. Jim,
I have one thing to add. According to my research, contractual law research, anything that you want as a disclaimer needs to be put right after the signature or above the signature. So you could put trustee not as otherwise and then sign below. So but just make sure that it is part of the contract. Don't make it down below after the contract is signed. That makes sense?
So the way I sign my one of my accounts is I just sign my name and I put a comma sole trustee on the same line. Is that what you want?
Yeah, or above. You know, you could actually put it in the contract just before your signature, you know, signed by the trustee, not as otherwise, and just sign it. That
okay.
way it's part of the body of the contract.
Right, okay.
When you probably get with an attorney to find out exactly how that works. But
and when you say I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. But when you say contract, you're talking about the check.
I'm talking about the trust or a contract. I'm talking about anything that you're joint venturing in, anything that you're doing where you have to sign something and you want them to know that that you're the trustee. It needs to
okay.
be usually in the body or right after the signature. It's probably
okay.
best to put it in both places, really. I'll put
okay.
a little tidbit together on that. I did this research. I'll pull that paper up and find it again and put something
okay.
together also.
Okay.
Perfect.
All right. Anybody has a question, just please star 6. Either that or we're just going to have to keep talking about something. Yeah, I've had acting strictly in the capacity of trustee on my checks, I don't know, 30 years now, something like that. And I've never had a bank tell me they can't do it. I sometimes have to tell the guy that's opening the account for me, they'll look at it and say, I can't do this. I said, the bank check printing company will do it, believe me. He's, oh, you're right, no problem. So that's not a big deal. It just covers you. Make sure that you are a trustee and not acting personally. As Jim was mentioning earlier about setting up trusts for real estate, et cetera, you know, we do encourage you when you do buy that house to put it in a real estate trust. It is a lot easier process if you buy a house in the name of the trust because it just makes it a lot cleaner. However, if you are paying off an existing mortgage, just, you know, let us know and we can put that house, an existing real estate, into a real estate trust for you. And, you know, as you mentioned, make sure you have enough in this trust. Let's say you're looking at $1 million house. So, well, you know, put $2 million in the trust. That's enough to pay for the property taxes. It's enough to pay for maintenance. It's enough to pay for decorating, enough to pay for insurance, landscaping, whatever. And whatever money is in there can be put to work. So it's a self-funding trust. So you always have enough money in there to pay for those items without continuing to try to pull money from somewhere else. Same thing with a vehicle trust. You know, make sure there's enough money in there to keep it going for a while. And although it sounds like we're just trying to sell more trusts by suggesting one house per real estate trust or one car for vehicle trust, it goes back to you don't want to put all your eggs in one basket. I think I mentioned once before, if you have your Jaguar and your Lincoln Navigator in the same trust, and you have an accident with one, the other one is a risk as well. Jimmy, you had an example of that, of speeding and hitting each other at certain speeds. Do you want to go through that again?
Sure. The reason we want to see separate trust for the vehicles is because if you're traveling down a two-lane road and you're approaching a car coming at you at 60 miles an hour, you're traveling 88 feet per second. So that's 176 feet per second closing rate. If one of you sneezes as you get near each other, you might have a catastrophic failure, you know, so to speak. And all the pieces need to be picked up by somebody else. So you want to make sure that your car, each car is in a separate trust, because if you have that incident, no matter who's at fault, somebody's going to get sued. So you just
yeah.
want to make sure that they don't get both your cars or all your cars. Same with a house. Don't put more than one piece of real estate in a trust or a commercial building. They have to be an individual trust to protect them. Remember, you don't have ownership. You have 100% control. And if you only have control, the only thing they can do is come after you as the person that may have made the mistake and sneezed, you know, in my example. and they only can come after you and garnish your wage or something like that, but they can't come after anything else that you've got. This is all in trust.
Right, makes sense. Again, folks, just star six if you have a question, and we will do our best to answer it.
We're doing too good of a job, Carol.
We must be, my goodness. A lot of people have asked me lately about charitable trusts or foundations. We do have what we call a charitable trust, but it is not a foundation. It's not a 508. It's not a 501c3. It's merely another trust that you decide, okay, I have all this money now. I want to give away $10 million. So you can put the $10 million in that trust, and that's the trust you're going to work with to do that charitable giving, whether it's funding somebody else's project for some humanitarian needs, giving $100, $100 a month to somebody at your church, whatever it is, that's going to be your charitable giving. But it's not a 501c3.
Not tax deductible to you.
It's not tax deductible. I mean, depending, if you give to a 501c3, that of course is tax deductible to you. But if you just give it to somebody, it's not tax deductible. So, I mean, those are the differences. It's not a foundation. It's not a 508. It's just another trust that you just set aside some money for. And let's see what else can we talk about. We've talked about real estate trusts. We've talked about vehicle trusts, charitable trusts, impersonal property trusts. You know, Judy and I have kidded about this one for a long time. We just like to call that one the goody trust because that's where the jewelry is going to go, right, Jude?
Whoops, guilty. Oh, my God, mine's all set up.
I know it is.
Ready to go.
I think we're all so ready to go. I just had a thought. It just went away. I hate it.
Well, I have one for you then.
Okay, good. You go for it.
We need to talk about triple play. So now that you've got all your assets and protected, what about your future? What about you? So the triple play comes into this right about now. If you think about it, you've got all your money coming in. Now you got to start protecting your future. So, Carol, why don't you talk about a little bit about the triple play for me?
Okay, well, thanks for bringing that up, Jim. Estate planning is not just about the money. I mean, everything's about the money. What am I going to do with the money? Well, obviously, it's a very big consideration. But you have to plan for yourself, as Jim just said. You have to make sure that you have your ducks in a row personally. So the triple play includes a pour-over will. And the pour-over will states that anything that I own personally upon my death pours over into whatever trust I designate. And you name as an executor, successor, executor, just like you do normally. Our pour-over will does not have any provisions for guardianship of children. This is just a money thing. Mostly a money and property thing. It doesn't have anything to do with guardianship. I'm not an attorney, so we don't go there. But it's very, very effective at getting your stuff out of your name and into the trust. If whatever you still own is worth a certain amount, and I don't know what the amount is anymore, it may still have to be probated, but at least there's no argument about who gets it. The triple play also includes a durable power of attorney. Now, I'm pretty sure that a lot of us are planning on doing a great deal of traveling after this occurs. So let's say something comes up and you are in Europe. You're skiing in the Alps. And you got to sign something. How can you do that? Well, granted, we have Skype and we have faxes and we have email, but they want a live person. So that's why you need a durable power of attorney. A power of attorney is somebody that can act for you in your absence. Whether you are ill, whether you're just unavailable, whatever, they can act for you in your absence. And they have the written legal permission to do that. And one of the really important things about the triple play is the healthcare directive. As many of you know, even going to the doctor now, they ask you, do you have a healthcare directive? If you do not, they give you one, but all it does is give them the right to treat you. Same thing with the hospice. God bless you.
Thank you.
With the triple play, the health care directive that we provide, it covers pretty much soup to nuts. I mean, from I want this to happen in this event, I don't want this to happen in this event. If I'm in a coma, I do or do not want special, what's the word I want? I don't want extreme measures to keep myself alive. I do want a DNR. I have plans for my burial. I don't have plans for my burial. I want to be buried. I want to be cremated. All these things are covered in like 7 or 8 page document. It the three of them together, which is why we call it a triple play, are a very comprehensive package of you taking care of yourself and planning for whatever you can't plan for now. I mean, think about, especially with the healthcare directive, say you have a heart attack and you're in the hospital or you're in a coma. Your kids are going, oh, my God, what would Mom want me to do? What would Mom want me to do? Oh, I don't know. Did you talk to her? Did she talk to you? No, now you've got it all written out on paper. You've got Mom's wishes. You've got Dad's wishes. Or they have your wishes. So it's just a good plan just to have with you. In fact, my husband and I obviously have one. I keep it with me whenever we travel. I have a we have our agents and successor agents. They both have copies. And fortunately for us, we've got one on the West Coast and one on the East Coast, so it works really, really well. But just something to consider. I have heard that attorneys charge as much as $10,000 for these, which is, just blows me away. Ours are $275 for a single person or $350 for a couple. So it's very, very reasonable, and it's the kind of peace of mind that no other insurance can give you, really, because it's something you need to do for yourself.
Well, to complement that, both my parents have passed in the last few years, and we had all this set up using this system here. And so I could take care of both of them. My mom passed first, and she was in the hospital just before she passed. And I had the medical directive. My father was just, he was, beside himself. He didn't know what to do, and he had a little issue with himself, and he just couldn't handle it. He just couldn't do it. And I'm the oldest son, so it was all left up to me. So I handled both of them and their estates and such. And upon my dad's and my mom's passing, there was no probate. Everything was already predisposed. I took care of the medical directive. My dad did not want resuscitation after three attempts and so on and so forth. And it worked perfectly. It was a very easy transition for me, paper-wise. Not otherwise, but paper-wise.
Yeah.
Right.
And Jim, didn't you just have a personal experience as well with your friend John?
Yeah, it's a fun story, everybody. You'll really enjoy this. My business partner and closest friend since the early 90s has had to have a surgery, and it was kind of a touch-and-go surgery, and we're all concerned. And I had a directive there filed, and I brought in, and they didn't pay any attention to it. So as soon as the surgery was over, they're supposed to call me and said they called his son, and his son did not know about the surgery. We were trying to keep this quiet.
Oh, dear.
I know. So he gets the hospital, he calls me, and, of course, I get there, and I am upset. And I said something to the nurse. I was upset. I says, hey, he's my partner. I'm supposed to, be notified right away. I said, partner. He's my business partner.
Oh, my God.
And she goes, my gosh, it's not the computer, sir. I am so sorry. We'll correct that right now. And then every time I went by there, she'd say, well, your partner's doing good today and this and that. And so they assumed.
It was your personal partner.
Yeah, we still laugh about that. John and I joke about that. He says, well, I'm going to go to the doctor's office. He went yesterday. I got to go to the doctor's office for my follow-up. He says, shall I tell my – I'm going to call my partner if there's a problem. You bet.
Oh, that's so cute. That's so cute.
We have left it intact. We have not said anything to correct that. If they made their assumption. If their assumption is in error, that's their problem, not my problem. So
right.
As far as they, whenever he goes to the doctor's office, sometimes I go with him because he needs help. But they treat me really, really well.
Too funny. In any event, folks, it's something
funny.
You really need to have. You really need to consider it. As I say, it sort of tops off the estate planning.
Certainly does. And, you know, then that gives you a full package. Something should happen to you, all your relatives that are involved, you know, they'll have an idea what to do. You'll have somebody that will notify everybody, and then you'll have the directive, you'll have the probate will. But there's no argument. I mean, you've already signed
right.
it. It's notarized. It's a legal document, and nobody can argue with that. So it also, you know, it's kind of like my dad used to say, well, where there's a will, there's a lot of family.
That's a good
oh
one.
Oh, my goodness. That's delicious.
Yep.
That's so good.
That's precious.
Yeah. He was a sage man. Yeah.
So what else can we talk about? How do we get money out of the trust, Jim?
Well, you can write a check. You can use a debit card. you can get it just about any way you want to get it out. I mean, you have to be careful what you do with it, in as much as you don't want to pull it out and have a taxable event. The different things we haven't talked about also is if you own a piece of real estate and it's in trust, you may want to pay rent to the trust.
Yep.
So you have cash flow in that account to pay for all your bills for the house. Just a thought.
Yeah. And it's merely money going out of one pocket into another pocket. They're both still
right.
your pockets.
That's right. And
exactly.
The idea of that is not to have the government in your pocket.
There you go. There you go. People ask me all the time, well, how do I get money out of the trust? And there are actually several ways. I mean, not to be too facetious about it. And Jim is right. You write yourself a check. But what is the reason for the check? You can pay yourself a salary, which is a good idea. You want to show some actual income. People say, well, how much? It doesn't matter how much. You can make it $500 a month. You can make it $500 a day. It's up to you. And if you decide that $5,000 a month is not enough, then give yourself a raise. But as Jim said, this is a taxable event because it's income to you. As a certificate holder, you can also take a distribution. Again, that is taxable to you. And that's something you want to do regularly anyway. Maybe you want to do a distribution once a year. And that's something we can get into on another call. The trust can also pay for some of your expenses. I mean, as a trustee, you are charged with the duty of increasing the financial standing of your trust. So that's going to mean, I need to make a few more contacts here. So maybe I should, you know, take this wealth manager out to lunch. Actually, he should take you out to lunch. But if you want to do something like that, the trust can pay for it. If you want to join a golf club, because that's really a good place to meet a lot of wealthy people, the trust may be able to pay for that. Well, you want to take your family on a cruise, because when you get to South America, you want to look at some property. So you pick up brochures. You pick up business cards. It's a legitimate business expense. So I wouldn't necessarily have the trust pay for that new bathing suit, but it can certainly pay for most of the expenses for that trip. So there's all kinds of creative legal ways to get money out of the trust. You can also take a loan from the trust, but you do have to post security. It's just a promissory note that you put inside the trust. It's still money going from one pocket to another trust, to another pocket, but it's money. And you do have availability of that money. One of the things that Jim and I have talked about in the past is funding, and we just talked about this a little while ago, funding a new trust. So let's say you do want to buy that $1 million house. Rather than borrowing the money from your mother-lode trust, your mother-lode trust is going to fund a brand new real estate trust. And again, you're going to fund it with $2 million, pay the $1 million for the house, they let the other $1 million pay for expenses, and go to work. So, you know, as I said, there's a lot of legal ways to get money out of the trust. Most of them do not have too much of a tax implication. Again, you know, we really can't talk too much about taxes. You know, we've had no caller. Oh, we do have a caller here. Excuse me. Hang on a second. Gary, is that you?
Yeah. Hey, Carol, this is Gary.
Hi.
Hi, got a question. Regarding paying yourself a salary, would the trust then create a 1099 for you to give to the IRS, or if we have an IRS, to pay taxes? Because we'd have to have some documentation we're getting a salary. That was my question.
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
That was a real easy answer then, too. Okay.
Yeah,
I know in businesses sometimes...
Yeah,
sometimes you need a W-9 from them initially to get their Social Security number and everything, but I'd have that because it would be me. And so I would just issue a 1099 from the trust, and then that would be my proof that this is salary and it's taxable and I have to pay tax on this money.
Right. Yeah.
That's pretty straightforward then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, you're going to have accountants, CPAs, and they'll help you out with all of that.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Thank
now,
you.
Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
What was the second thing? After that, you were talking about something else, and it slipped my head, and I was going to ask a question about it, and I totally lost it. But it was along the same vein.
Okay, and you were talking about, I was mentioning distributions. As certificate holders, which you all are, you are entitled to a distribution of funds should the trustee decide to make one. So let's say at the end of the year, for some reason, you decide to take chunk of money on the trust. So you make a distribution to the certificate holders, you and if you're married, your spouse. So you've got this extra $10,000 for whatever amount. You've got this extra $10,000. You get five, your wife gets five. And it's a distribution, it's overage. Put it this way, it's overage money in the trust. You both get some money, you get the cash, but it's still a taxable event to you. And again, the trust would have to give you a 1099.
Okay, very good. I think that covers it then. Thank you, Carol.
You're welcome.
Anybody
else? Go ahead, Jim.
Also, a loan. You take a loan from the trust.
Yes.
It's not taxable income to you because it's a loan. You pay it back. And
yes,
you can extend that out on interest only or extend it out for quite some time. Again, that's going to be up to the CPA's new tax system, how we do that. But as it stands right now, if you take a loan, that's not taxable to you.
That's right. And you do have to at least make interest payments at some point.
Right. Exactly.
Otherwise, it will be considered a gift. But, you know, again, we're getting into tax issues, and we don't know what they're going to be.
Yep.
Just don't know what they're going to be. Anyway, folks, it's about 5 minutes of the hour. We have any more callers? Well, Jim, Judy, I think we've about covered it, unless either one of you have anything to add.
Well, I think I want to add that you did a phenomenal job today. I didn't jump in there too much because you did such a great job, and you wrote the notes. We'll make sure this is available to everybody. I just think that everybody needs to understand that we're close. Of course, it goes back to we're closer today than we were yesterday, whenever that date may come, but we're close. And so start
awesome.
Getting all your affairs and all your paperwork ready because, go ahead.
I was going to say, I was trying to be silly. My outfit's on one hanger ready to go.
There you go. Yeah. So I would say that, you know, my car's got a computer in it, and I've already programmed the destination, but I don't know where they're going to send me, so I can't do that yet. So anyway, that's all I wanted to add, Carol.
Well, thank you, Jim. Thank you, Judy. Jim, you want to give your contact information?
Sure. My name is Jim Knox, KNOX. I'm on the West Coast. I live in Salem, Oregon. My phone number is 503-583-6791. I'm always available from 9 o'clock in the morning, my time, to around 6 o'clock in the evening. I'll take calls later from time to time. It's not a big deal. And then my email is security@indicatorinformation.com.
Thank you. Well, everybody, thank you so much for joining us. I would like to add that our trusts are still just $1,495. Secondary trust or family trust are $1,195. We also pay a 20% referral fee, and we take all major credit cards. Right now, Jim has been just absolutely cranking them out. So turnaround time is less than a week right now. I seriously expect post-RV it will be longer than that. Also, post-RV, Jim and I are both going to take a little bit of time off to take care of our own affairs. So, you know, I
and
encourage
let me add,
you. Go ahead,
let
Jim.
Let me add to that. One of the reasons why we're going to do this as soon as we can and take a little time off is so we can, we'll know exactly the system, and then we'll get out what we know right away to everybody so you can be better prepared.
Yes, yes, good plan. So anyway, as I said, he's just been cranking them out lately. I suggest that you get, if you don't already have your trust, it's time. I don't think there's any more time to drag your heels and say, oh, well, I'll give it another week or another month or whatever. I don't think we have another week or another month. I believe that we are there. So, again, thank you so much for joining us today. Thank you, Judy. Thank you, Jim. My name is Carol Werlius. My telephone number is 425-820-8090, and I am currently in the Central Time Zone. Again, I take calls the same as Jim does for about 9 to 6. Try to take the weekends off. My email is info@indicatorinformation.com. Jim and I are happy to answer all of your emails and all your calls. So everybody have a great weekend and go RV. Thanks, guys. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you, everybody. Have a great weekend. Bye-bye for now.